Thank you very much. My name is Virginia, and I'm a member of the Al-Anon Family Groups, and my home group is the Thursday Morning Group in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi. I don't know about you, but I didn't used to spend Saturday mornings like this. There was a lot that had to be done. You had to get cash money, because where we ended up Saturday night, they didn't take checks. And you had there were days when you had to worry. And the children were a great inconvenience because they wanted to do things, and I wanted to sit and worry. Now, I thought that was my responsibility because, you see, I grew up with the concept that behind every good man, there's a good woman, and my husband was a drunk, so what did that make me? You know, the awesome sense of responsibility the family members have is like a cancer. It grows, and it makes us, well, you know, lots of times when people will say, what's the difference between being sober and being dry, and what's a dry drunk? I say, honey, that's what we've been on all these years. Because a dry drunk, as you know, is somebody that is just physically not taking that old flit, as they call it, but is a basket case otherwise. And I was a basket case when I got here, and I did not get here seeking a higher plane and lofty ideas and to float around the world and be a good woman. I came mad as hell. I came because after a lot of years of doing everything I could think of and everything that had been suggested to me, to no avail, he'd gone off with a bunch of strangers, total strangers, and wasn't drinking. And I was mad. And so I came to my first meeting. I think in most of us that are in the Al-Anon family groups, and you, by the way, you will hear me frequently say Al-Anon family groups rather than just Al-Anon. I am an Al-Anon member of the Al-Anon family groups because in our fellowship we have Al-Anon members and we have Al-Ateen members. But the fellowship to which I belong is the Al-Anon family groups. I have never heard any of my friends in AA get up and say, I'm a member of Alcoholics, or I'm a member of Anonymous. And I have a theory that there are many people out there that are misinformed and think that the Al-Anon family groups are just for the spouses of alcoholics or AA members. And I think we have many other family members that go elsewhere through ignorance of what our program is. So I believe in using the full name of our fellowship to let those know that family covers all relationships. Because my experience in having a number of alcoholics in my family is that I am the common denominator in all these relationships. And the relationship never gets better until I do, no matter what the others do. Only when I get better. And I think that the relationship, the educational background, economics, anything you want to name, are just circumstances in regards to this disease. It is human beings that get sick and human beings that get well. And that has nothing to do with relationship, sex, race, creed, or anything else. It is the human being that gets sick and the human being that gets well. And I've seen a lot of people come into the program and prosper materially, and they think they're getting well. And there's a dead spot inside them, and they don't know what's wrong. And they don't understand. Since Joe got sober, we've built a beautiful home. Since Joe got sober, the business has prospered, but nothing's changed inside here. Because the circumstances are not what make us sick, and the change for the better of circumstances do not make us well. It has to be an inside job. At any rate, I was born on the eastern shore of Maryland, down in what they referred to as the duck hunting, liquor drinking country. And I grew up within a family where drinking was just a way of life. I never had any strong opinions that it was a moral issue or that you were sinful or there was anything wrong in it, and there was no thought of hiding it, and none of that in my thinking. And I lived down there a very nice way of living, and the family was quite well off and all. And every summer we spent a month with our maternal grandparents in western Pennsylvania. And one summer we went on that annual visit, and we never were to return to Maryland, that my brothers, my sister, and I. And I lived with adults that believed that children should be seen and not heard. And if you had a question for which you didn't have the answer, it didn't make any difference. Don't bother to ask it, because if you were to know, they would have already told you, and they wouldn't answer your questions. And I was to find out later on that what had happened in that period of time is that the Depression, the Big Depression, had hit, and this family was wiped out. And I saw these people fall apart and go to pieces. And I know through repeated fourth-step inventories, I started developing at that time a reverse snobbery as respected people with education, money, social position, because I saw them as shallow and vain. And it was a long time after I'd been in the Al-Anon family groups before I realized it's perfectly all right to be well-educated. It's perfectly all right to have money. It's perfectly all right to be socially prominent if that isn't the only thing you have. Because, you see, I've come to believe those people had no inner resources on which to rely, and when the going got tough, they couldn't take it. They had nothing to sustain them and soothe them and support them. But at any rate, I lived with these grandparents, and though this was an entirely different background, home style, and these were staunch, excuse me, Presbyterians, and we went to church every time the doors opened, and youth choir, Christian Endeavor, you name it. There was no drinking in this home, except when an uncle, their son, occasionally would come around, having gotten drunk, and yet another wife had run him off. But I didn't know that. I didn't identify that because it wasn't talked about. You didn't talk about those things. As the older I get, the more grateful I've moved on from appreciation for those grandparents. I've moved into a deep sense of gratitude. And I not long ago went to their grave in Pennsylvania and said to them, "Mama and Granddad, I didn't realize what a sacrifice for a couple in their 70s to take in four children from age 7 to 17 and never complain and never make us feel unloved or unwanted and see to it that we were well clothed and well fed. And yet I know that this man in his 70s, who too had lost everything, had to go back to work at age 70 to provide for these four grandchildren." Now, my father never left Maryland, and he was to die shortly thereafter. And my mother left. And I said after I came into the program that she had abandoned us. And then I came to realize that isn't what she did. That's what I felt, abandoned. And I know through repeated fourth-step inventories, I start developing that misplaced sense of responsibility. I thought, what did she see in me that she couldn't stay? And after I was grown and children were born to us, I couldn't imagine going off and not knowing if your children were fed or clothed, getting an education, if they were having anything good in their life or anything about them. And she had done this. And I had a love-hate feeling towards this woman. For a number of years before I came into the program, if you had asked me about my parents, I said they were dead. And I was always uncomfortable when people sympathized with me that both of my parents were dead. But you see, I found lying about my mother was easier to live with than the questions you asked me when I said I didn't know where she was. It reflected very poorly that a woman would go and leave her children, and I couldn't, that was too painful. Well, I lived with these grandparents until they died within a short time of one another. And when I was 11 years old, I became a ward of the Orphans Court of the state of Pennsylvania. And my legal status was babe in arms. And I felt like a non-entity. For a long time, my report cards had been signed by a name different than mine, and that was questioned. These grandparents, and I can understand why, there weren't any friends to come spend the night. And also, I'm sure in their concern to provide and to protect me, I was not allowed to go and spend the nights anyplace else. I was as tall when I finished the eighth grade as I am now. I wasn't as wide, but I was as tall. And I was a misfit because, you see, I had already started the internalizing. I was talking to somebody the other night. There were many Virginias. There was the Virginia there was with when I was one set of people, and there was the Virginia when I was with another set of people. There was the Virginia at school and the Virginia at home. But then there was another Virginia inside that no one knew about, and I wouldn't look at. I would not look at. When I was 17, I approached the orphan's court and asked permission to leave Pennsylvania. And I relate when I hear people talk about geographical cures. I thought I equated unhappiness and sorrow and being out of step and all of that with Pennsylvania. And I thought, if I get away from here, it's going to be better. But when I got off that train in L.A., I got off with me. Oh, academically I did quite well, but I'm the original dumb Dora. I didn't know that I got off that train with me. In the next few years, I was to do a considerable amount of drinking that gave me pause to reflect when I got here in which room I belonged. I ran with a drinking crowd, but I always had been attracted to people that drank. And I think the earlier years at home with my father and mother, when things were not as routine and scheduled and disciplined as they had been with my grandparents, was attractive to me. I was rooming in the Evangeline Residence for Women in Los Angeles with a woman from the Carolinas. And by this time, I had a brother in the South Pacific and a brother in the European Theater. And my sister was traveling around the country with a GI husband. My grandparents were dead. In fact, is everybody in the, we were the only ones left, my brothers, my sister and I, because we were the only grandchildren on either side of the house. So Elizabeth said that she was going to North Carolina, and I said, well, wait, I'll go with you. And I, you see, I've always been running from something or running towards something. And I've never, most of my life, I didn't even have a goal in the running towards. It was more the running from. But at any rate, I went with her and came to North Carolina. And very shortly thereafter, I met the man to whom I am still married. Now, we talk a lot about miracles in the program. And sometimes I see people kind of scratching their heads or all. And if you've never heard of a miracle, in one sentence, I shall give you one. Quote, I'm back in Virginia, are alive and still married after 45 years, period, end quote. Now that is a miracle. Because what we did to one another, what we did in spite of one another, we should neither one of us be alive or sane or here with you today. I think that I started writing scripts long before I came into the program and heard about script writing. I wrote a script. Buck says I asked him, by the way, to marry him, me, and he said, I think he asked me. It really is immaterial. We knew for 21 years we both had made a mistake, but we wouldn't give in. We were going to make it work if it killed us, and it almost did. But I remember not knowing that me inside of me that I had never really looked at, not knowing that I needed to be needed, that I wanted to be wanted. Not knowing anything about those God-given instincts for love and acceptance and security. Not knowing of those. I wrote a script one Friday night. And my line was, I'm going back to California. And he was to respond, oh no, don't go, I love you, I need you. So I say, I think I'll go back to California. And he hadn't studied the script because he said, when are you leaving? Well, my false pride was such that I couldn't say. I just wanted to see what you would say. Saturday morning, I went downtown and I bought a ticket and I went back to California. And sometimes I forget to tell, and I'm so glad I'm remembering this morning, he came to California and got me. Sober. Now, we got drunk coming back from California. And if you could imagine 45 years ago, if you could imagine a son of yours that you love dearly is speaking of being very interested in someone that has no family, is not from your part of the country. In other words, I was a foreigner, and they didn't want their dear boy marrying me. And oh, the years I wish they had won, you know. But at any rate, we were going to get married in the fall. We returned to California in the spring. But instead, we went ahead and we were married. And I remember thinking along the lines, more of a feeling of rather than thoughts, that now I have someone to love and someone that will love me, and everything's going to be fine. The reverse snobbery was not concerned with the fine house on the hill and all of that, because those people didn't end up happy. But you see, when Beck and I got married, the bottle came into our marriage with us. And until he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, every Christmas was a drunken Christmas. And the Christmas season lengthened. Early on, Christmas started about the 15th of December and ended up a couple days after New Year's. And then it started about Thanksgiving and went to Valentine's Day. And then it started about Halloween and went to St. Patrick's Day. And, you know, it just kept to be a longer and longer and longer period of celebration. But things weren't working out for me in this marriage from the standpoint it wasn't everything's fine. And I didn't know what was wrong. And I looked at his family, which were a good family. You know, so many times I hear people get up and they say, my in-laws, and everybody laughs and everybody does this. I had good in-laws. Fine people that were good to me, accepted me and loved me and treated me well, in spite of the fact that they didn't wish that their son hadn't married me. It wasn't that they opposed me. They would have preferred he'd married somebody from home. They were good to me, good people. But I looked at this family and realized there were no other drunks in that family. So once again, I revert back, you know, why did Mother leave? Because of me. Why is Becca drunk? Because of me. And of course, he was telling me, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't get drunk. But you know, that's, so many times we think people are on ego trips when they think they're arrogant and cock of the walk and know-it-all. You're on an ego trip as well when you think you're responsible for everything that's wrong. I know that this feeling of being responsible for all these wrongs was very self-centered and very egotistical. Beck and I were married about 5 years. We had two daughters, and we had an opportunity to go into business for ourselves. And we moved to South Carolina, and we're very successful. And it was just going fine. And we worked together, and in my working with him, felt a need that I didn't even know I had, and that was to be successful in something. I already felt that the marriage wasn't successful, and it was my fault because of his drinking. I obviously wasn't a good mother. I had nothing to identify with. I didn't know. I couldn't look at our children and think, how did I feel when I was their age? Because I didn't grow up with that type of situation. And so running the business was very therapeutic for me. But any time I expect my total being to be improved because of something as insignificant as that, it won't work. You know, it's terminal. It has an end period to it. Beck was coming and going, joining all the clubs in town and out of town and all of that. And I, for a long time, it was fine with me because I was running the business, you know, when he wasn't there. And I felt good about that. But I remember he had been gone off on a trip And by this time, you know, I've tried everything. I've been raising hell when he came home. I've been silent when he'd come home. I've invited his drinking friends in. I had refused them entrance into the door or into the business or anything else. And so I decided, all right, he's been gone, and I've been taking care of the children and taking care of the home and taking care of the business. When he comes back, I'm just going to ignore him. I'm just going to go on as I've been doing without while he wasn't here. And he returned, and I wasn't feeling well a short time after that, and I went to the doctor, and he told me that I was pregnant with our third child. Now, that's failure. And if you don't understand that, I'm not going to explain it. But if you're not even going to speak to someone and you end up pregnant, that's failure. And I remember Buck came in one day, and I told him that I could not continue working. I had to, I just couldn't stand the hours and all. And I went to our home and to await the birth of our third child. And this business got drunk up, as they say. You know, a lot of things in our lives got drunk up. And on Christmas Eve of 1958, Beck had been gone on a drinking spree, and I didn't know where he was. I hadn't heard from him, and I decided I couldn't get a job in this town. The business was gone, and I couldn't get a job in this town, and I would have told you, and long after I came into the program, I would have told you, because of his reputation, and that is a part of it. But also, I wasn't very employable either, because if someone called and told me that Buck was at Papa Nash's at Myrtle Beach, I had to go see if he was. And I didn't always take the children with me. And that's no responsibility of his. That's entirely mine. But at any rate, I hadn't heard from him. But I went back to Charlotte, and I got work there and found a place for the girls and I to live. And I went back to South Carolina. I didn't have any money. Never had any money. Never have any money. Didn't have any money, but I borrowed $100 from someone, and someone that owed us some money had a truck, and I went to him and asked him if he'd move some furniture, and he said that he would. I was so afraid of what Buck would think when he drove in the yard that Christmas Eve afternoon as we were loading the furniture. I was afraid because I had gone and gotten a job to provide food and clothing and a roof over the heads of our children. That is the depth of the sickness in the non-alcoholic. My heart was beating as fast as if you were hitting my ears. I said I hadn't heard from him, but I'd heard of him. I'd had telephone calls. Virginia, I thought you would like to know that Buck da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Now, I'm a firm believer that there's a special corner in hell for those people. They don't do anything to encourage or to calm or sustain or help. They just give you more garbage. You know, the unknown is fertile ground. You know, when I don't know something, I can just imagine all sorts of stuff. And so I'm imagining all sorts of stuff about him, plus these phone calls, you know. But he returned that Christmas Eve, and I can remember saying to him, I'm not leaving here to leave you. I'm leaving here because I've gotten work in Charlotte, and you can go with us if you want. And in a little bit, he said, all right, let's go. And I thought, he still loves us. And I think it's important for me to remember when something is okay, someone says to me is okay, not to dig into it. Because you see, after he got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, okay, let's go, because he was flat broke and didn't have any place else to go. But we went back to Charlotte, and silly thing, the dumb Dora that I am, I was to think, once again, it can't get any worse. Of course it can get worse. And if you think that you can do the things that you're doing that aren't quite on the beam and it'll be all right, don't give up hope. You can lose it all too. We did. But I have to remember also that recovery has the same reality as the disease. That's important to remember, that recovery is just as available to us we are just as susceptible to recovery as we were to the illness. It depends on what our focus is. And if you are working on your defects of character, they'll probably grow. But if you take a look at the opposite of your defective character and work on that, you'll be concentrating on the positive and that will grow. But anyhow, we went back to Charlotte and everything wasn't going to get any worse, but then it got worse, you know, and I'd walk around the house in the middle of the night, put the children to bed, wringing my hands, God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I can remember that vividly. Now, if my life depended upon it, I cannot tell you what I was distressed over, what was the crisis, but because I was all consumed with this, oh my, oh my. And you know, no matter where you live, when the drunk's car turns in the drive, the lights hit a certain wall and you know it's coming to your house, or there's a sound from that fender got rumpled last week, or those windows that are loose, or that door that's tied on, or what have you, and you know he's home. So you run, jump in bed for two reasons. And the first one, I'm sure you know. And the second one is the next morning, then you say, what time did you come home? And he'd say, oh, of course now I know now, I didn't even know he was home, but anyhow, what time did you come home? Oh, it was about 4 o'clock. You're a damn liar. It was 5. Now, I didn't see what a liar I was. I was asleep, but I knew. We went up and down and in and out and around. It may have been a different holiday. I may have started the argument instead of you. Whatever. The reality of the disease of alcoholism has nothing to do with the circumstance. It has to do with the damage that's done inside. And I, for one, have believed for a long time, if those scars were visible, if you were to surgically open us, I would defy you to tell me the difference to identify an alcoholic from a non-alcoholic. Because I think the disease of alcoholism is a killer. Not just of alcoholics. It's a killer. And there's a lot of people that are not in their grave, but they're dead. And if you don't believe it, look in their eyes. Look in their eyes. They're dead. And it's sad. They don't have to be. But at any rate, it went in and out. Buck had so many automobile accidents. God, I was a casualty insurance underwriter and had the insurance with the company. You know, on all these assigned risk apps, boy, I got them first. They weren't going to know my husband was under the assigned risk. But anyhow, it's immaterial, the things that happen. But that's what I was asked to come and share, is my experience, my strength, and my hope. And this is the background from which I came when I came to a meeting. I went in on a Monday to fix lunch. And one of my attributes on early inventory was that I was thrifty, because anyone that bought Tupperware was a spendthrift, when you could use mayonnaise jars or pickle jars to store leftovers. And if you bought paper towels when you could launder tea towels, that was certainly excessive. And I reached in the refrigerator and got a mayonnaise jar with leftovers. It's not legal to throw them away until they're green, you know that. And I got it out, and I put it under my arm, and reached to get something else, and the lid wasn't secure, and the contents went all over the kitchen floor. And what was normal for me, at the top of my lungs, God, what else do you expect of me? That damn drunken, now this mess. Wait a minute, he's not drunk. He's sitting in the living room waiting for him to fix lunch. How long since he came home drunk? Where is it he said he'd been going? Who's been telephoning him? I know they're sober. I can smell a drunk on the phone to this day. Clean, well-dressed people have been coming by the office to see him. The most traumatic thing of all, he'd been going out every night and coming home when he said he'd come home sober. the greatest amend any alcoholic can make to the people they've hurt. Now, you're going to be late and you call. We're going to chew you out until we find out we can believe that you will come when you say. It doesn't cost anything but to do what you say you'll do, and if you can't, admit you can't. You know, living in active alcoholism is like, for me, it was like being out in a small boat fishing. Have you ever been out in a small boat fishing? You don't stand there stiff-legged. You keep your knees bent and flexed, and you so you're prepared for a wake or a wind, wake of another boat or a wind or a branch or a snag or what have you. Prepared for any eventuality. That's what I was like in active alcoholism. He got sober, but I was still, you know, going like that. It wasn't fair that you all had gotten him sober after all I had done, and God knows I had done everything. You know, I thought that afternoon, they're doing a snow job on him. He's doing a snow job on them. They wouldn't be being as nice to him if they knew him like I know him. He's going to hit somebody up for some money just as sure as the world, and then they'll come here looking for him and ask me to pay it back. I thought, I bet he hasn't told them what a good wife I am. How I've stood by him through thick and thin. How I've raised these children. How I've run this business. I bet he hasn't told them that. And I thought, I wonder if he's told them about the things I've done that I don't want them to know. What about that beautiful crockerware bowl over there that I picked up and threw in a drunken rage? He was drunk and I was in the rage. What if he's told them about those things? Well, what really happened that afternoon is I had to face the reality, the truth, that something I had believed for years as being true was not. I had believed that if he would get sober, we would be all right. And he wasn't drinking, and my life hadn't changed one bit. I was confused. I was angry. I thought, I'm still sitting here running this business, and he's still doing his thing. Because you see, until I got here and I heard other alcoholics share, I really thought every time Buck went off and got drunk, he had fun and enjoyed it, and it was voluntary, willing. I really did. Because you see, he allowed me to think that because he never said, I'm sicker in hell. He never said, I'm sorry. He never said, I wish I hadn't. He never said, I feel terrible. He'd get up in the morning with a hangover and whistle to impress me. You know. And I used to say, if I'm ever kill him, it isn't going to be over drinking. It's for whistling in the morning. Because I'm not a morning person. But I decided, I don't care, drunk or sober, I'm sitting here. I'm not going to. I am going wherever he's going. I've been in jail with him. I've been to the bootlegger with him. I've been flat broke with him. I've been top of the heap with him. I don't know where it is he's going now. He's not going without me. I'm going too. Well, I couldn't say I want to go with you, or, you know, you just didn't do it. We had reached that point where we were two camps in one house. We did not communicate. So I got ready, and Buck said, well, I'll be back about 9:30 or 10. And I stood up and I said, well, I'm going too. And I had my reasons ready and just let him question it. And he said, all right, come on. I could have killed him. You know, could have killed him. I couldn't say when we got in the car, because there was no one else in the car, where are we going? Because then he'd know I didn't know. I didn't want him to know I didn't know. That is very important to people like me, family members like me. We don't want you to know we don't know, you know. And we throw out a lot of garbage to see what bait you'll take. Then we'll say, uh-huh, that's where you are, you know. You were at Sam's, no reaction. You were at Joe's, no reaction. You're at Papa Nash's. Well, uh-huh, that's where he was. That's where he was. But anyhow, we got in the car, and I'm like a blowfish out of water. We're going across town. I can't ask him, and I want to know. I still don't like to get in the car. I don't know where it's going. But then, you know, so we go drive up, and we walked in this building, and he pointed to a stairwell, and he said, they meet down there. Now, I didn't know who they were, but I'd die dead on the spot before I'd asked him. So I went downstairs. Now, I've accepted for a long time that God, of my understanding, was working in my life because I was never 12-stepped. There was never any AA that came and said, there's a place for you. None of that. I got here angry, and perhaps that's the only way I would have gotten here. I don't have any idea, and it's immaterial, whether I could have been honest if anyone had come and talked with me. It doesn't matter. But more importantly, I know God was working in my life that night because, you see, it was closed AA and an Al-Anon family group meeting. I'm so grateful I didn't get to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before I got to the Al-Anon family groups, because I would have become one of that legion non-alcoholic members of open AA meetings. And they are a pain to everybody. Everybody. You sit around places like this drinking coffee, and one of these cats comes out off the wall with something, and somebody will say, well, how long have you been sober? Well, I'm not an alcoholic. And they'll say, that's just like an Al-Anon. And I want to jump up and say, hell no, bitch, that's not an alcoholic. A marriage license doesn't make you a member of Al-Anon. A birth certificate, sharing the same pad, working the same place, none of that. You are not an Al-Anon member by association with an alcoholic, drunk or sober. Any member, more than you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless you go and walk the walk. You're a member of the Al-Anon family groups if you go to meetings, if you take these steps, if you study these steps, if you talk with people, if you sit and listen, if you try, if you're willing. The distance you travel is not important, but that you are willing to make the trip is important. Well, I had become quite a know-it-all because, you see, I couldn't understand how Buck and I could drink out of the same bottle, and he got into the trouble that I didn't get into. Now, I want you to know when I got locked up, it was because of him. I wasn't... Anyhow, well, that's another long story. I'll talk to you in the coffee room later about that one. But anyhow, and so I thought it must be that physically I can handle it better, or got more up here, stronger morals, higher standards, something different. And you know, a know-it-all is like somebody that's been in a blackout. Do you ever notice somebody that's coming off a blackout? They are so humble and so attentive to what you have to say till they find out what's went on while they were in a blackout. Well, a know-it-all is that way, and I was a know-it-all when I walked in that room that night. You know, you keep enough of a smile on your face that if something's real funny, they won't think that you're a wet blanket, but not too much of a smile so if it's sad, they won't think you're a clown. You know, just the right amount. I didn't ask any questions. I don't remember how they opened the meeting. I'm sure they did it then the same way we do now. But at any rate, a lady got up and she talked, and I identified with her. I did not know that's what I was doing. I did not know the language of the fellowship. I was a little piqued and ashamed of myself because this lady had started with much less than God had allowed me to start with as far as opportunity and ability. She started off when in active alcoholism by asking you if you would buy the yarn, and for $2 she would knit you a sweater. And if you would buy the cloth for $3, she would make you a dress, because she could neither read nor write and couldn't go out and get a job. And I was ashamed because I could read and write and I could go out and get a job. But she hadn't complained of that. She'd done it because it was what was in front of her and what was necessary. And that lady went on, and when I met her that night, she had put herself through school, gotten a GED, and had gone to accounting school and was working as a bookkeeper as one of the leading car dealerships in town. You see what can happen. Well, I thought that they were... I was amazed at what she was sharing, because she was sharing things that I wouldn't even look at head on in my own head, you know, over here peripheral. I knew it was there, but I wasn't going to look at it. what she was talking about. And I remember she said, the night that her husband picked up his 9-year chip, they had a son, they had a son born the night her husband was sober 9 months. And she said, we named him Chip. And everybody laughed. And I thought, what's so funny about that? I got lots of boys are called Chip, you know, Chip off the old. I didn't get them. These idiots and these tacky slogans, you know. But I was more comfortable there, and I started going to meetings on a regular basis. Now, I had started talking to a lady that was a visitor at that group that night. She thought I belonged to the group, and because I was talking to her, the group thought I'd come to the meeting with her. And so I wasn't given that thing we seem to beat the drum about so much anymore, and that is the newcomer welcome. But they gave me something that's finer than a newcomer welcome. They gave me a meeting that was based solely within the purpose of the confines of what our purpose is, and that attracted me. I don't know that phone numbers would have attracted me. I don't know all the glad handing and all, because I was suspect of anybody that was kind or loving or anyone that looked at me in any way other than I was something despicable. But they gave me something that attracted me. Well, I didn't know, I was never to see Ann again, by the way, in all these years. It's another reason I know God was working in my life. It was sufficient that she was in one room one night, willing to share in such a manner that it opened the door for me. I have heard, I've asked questions, I understand she moved to Florida and she's doing quite well. And I'm very grateful for Ann from Hawthorne Group in Charlotte, North Carolina, for being at the Queen City that night. I really am. But there was a little bit of a secret society mystery aspect then. You didn't go up like I could go up now and say, could you give me so-and-so's phone number? If so-and-so hadn't given you the phone number, you weren't to have it. And I wanted to talk to Ann a lot in the following weeks, but I didn't know where Ann was, and I didn't know that I could ask, and there wasn't the atmosphere that I could ask. But I thought that they were just too good to be true, and really they were so good and so sweet, it made me want to throw up in the middle of the floor. And I remember no one said damn or hell, and I think that's just a part of the English language if you've lived in alcoholism. And they talked about, since John's been sober and NAA and I've been in Al-Anon, everything's great. And I thought, what am I not learning? Because Buck and I are in the car going to a meeting. Get to the meeting, open the car door. Hi, how are you? Glad to see you. Yeah, glad you're back. Yeah, going to the meeting, have a good meeting. This God-given program, I'm so grateful for it. Yeah, see you. Yeah, I get back in the car. Now, what the hell are you talking about? You know, so everything was in ginger peachy. And I'm thinking, what am I not learning? What am I not learning? And the final blow came one night. I nearly died. This lady came in, and I'll say her husband's name was John, and she was Mary, and obviously John had gone back to drinking, and somebody said, well, how's John, Mary? And she said, well, he came home, and he was passed out on the floor, but I put a pillow under his head before I left, and I nearly threw up, because I thought, that was one of my fantasies. Buck passed out. With my ample proportions, you take the pillow over the head, you smother him to death, then you get up, you roll him over, he's facing the pillow, and they call the police and say, I came home and found my husband drunk and he's smothered in the pillow. And I think, all right, what degree of hysteria would you be experiencing if that really happened? I wanted to be just enough, but I didn't want to be real happy, you know? I wanted to be just enough. And I'd think about it, okay, well, how do I explain it to the kids if they walk in and find me lying over their father's head with a pillow? Because, you see, I'm a PTA president, and I'm a Sunday school teacher, and I sing in the choir, and I'm head of the employees club at work, and I'm a pillar in the community, and I'm pillow over their father's head. You got to explain these things. But always the bottom line was, he'll come to and beat the socks off of me. So once again, I was a failure, you know? Well, I started going to meetings, as I say, and I don't know why I never read Buck's big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I think every member of the Al-Anon family groups ought to read it. you'll find out in there that they're being told if they're taking their program seriously and people are sponsoring over there like they should sponsor over there, they're going to be told a lot of things that will make our life a hell of a lot easier. You know, it's perfectly all right and perfectly normal after years of active alcoholism to be suspect when an alcoholic that isn't drinking all of a sudden says, well, I'm going off tomorrow on a fishing trip and I'll be back Friday, when they've done that before and come back 2 months later. And you don't have any, they have yet to have a track record to let you know that you can really believe that. And so you feel real bad about these feelings of being suspect and questioning that. You know, what kind of a loving wife, or how grateful are you for his sobriety if you can't believe that? Well, if you read that book, you'll find out that their peers are telling him, your family and friends are not going to be suspect of you because your track record ain't so good, and you're going to have to prove yourself. So it takes away a lot of tension and a lot of stress. But anyhow, I went to, at that time, we used to go into a group, an open meeting, and put your name on a slip of paper, and for a quarter, and they get the price of a big book, they draw one, or even other books too. And that, I got one, drew my name one night, and I got home, and I went, read it. And I was absolutely amazed, because you see, by this time, I wasn't sure I belonged over there with those good, sweet-talking ladies and those fine, upstanding men and those good people that had a handle on everything and never talked of wanting to kill, never talked of hating police, never talked of power being cut off, never talked about being flat broke, never talked about trying to decide whether they should buy a pair of hose to wear in the winter or let their children have lunch at school. They didn't talk about those things. They didn't talk about so much except what was good and lofty and great. And I hadn't had any of those experiences, and I didn't identify, so I thought maybe I belonged across the hall. And then when I read that book, I knew I didn't belong across the hall. The edition I read didn't even mention Al-Anon in it at all, in any even addendum or footnote or anything else. So I knew I belonged in Al-Anon. By this time I went to a meeting and I heard another lady talk. And she rang my bell, but I thought she was going to be like Ann, that I wouldn't have a chance to talk with her again. I've had lots of chances to talk with her. And she was the one that set me on the road of a steady of the steps, because she said she went to meetings simply to have the opportunity to dump her garbage. And she said after the meeting there was always this one lady who would listen to her, and when she'd get it all out, this lady would say to her, well, have you tried the steps? She said she got so tired of hearing that, she decided, I'm going home, I'm going to do those steps, and I'm going to tell her they don't work, and that'll get that out of the way. And that was her approach, and she said she went home, she started on the steps, and things started changing. Well, light bulbs are going off for me when she's saying this, because I'm wanting things to change. You see, a part of why I wanted things to change was because we were going a lot of places together and people were saying, hi, Buck, how long now? That's great. Not saying a word to me. And I'm hurting. I haven't reached the point where I can talk that I'm hurting, that I can say to somebody, I'm hurting. I can't. Because I'm not supposed to be hurting because he's not drinking. I hadn't learned yet that my pain was my pain and his was his. So I decided I'd go home and I'd start steadying the steps. And as I say, I'm the dumb Dora. When I'm wrapped tight, don't say to me, easy does it, because I wouldn't be wrapped tight if I remembered how to easy does it. Don't tell me to let go and let God when I need to, because if I'm not doing it, I've forgotten how. So don't just tell me what to do, tell me how. And how I steady the steps is I get everything I can on the steps, and I read everything on step one, and I close the books, and I think about it. And I come to conclusions about that step at that time, and I go on and do the same thing through the steps and through the steps and through the steps. God granted me a lot of things that I didn't even know He was giving me. And one of the things that He granted me was when I initially started my study of the steps, was that sense to come to a conclusion about step one and move on, rather than do it right and then move on. Because if I had waited till I had done it right, I would still be on step one. Because every time I reach one level of understanding that I think would be desirable, there's still another level I want to reach. And so I would never have reached that point that I would have been willing to move on if I'd held on for perfection. I use all literature from both Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups in my study. And if you are not able in your study of the steps to use literature of Alcoholics Anonymous and paraphrase it to meet what you would do if you were to continue to do certain things, then don't read it. You have to be able to say, in some places it said, to do so will be to drink again. People like me have to paraphrase that and say, to do so will be to raise hell again, to be neurotic again, or whatever. And if you can't do that, don't read it until you can. But I want to talk about the steps because, you see, up until now, all I've talked about is what's gone on in my life. And there is no recovery for you in that. And there is no recovery for me in that. Because recovery is based in the 12 steps as we know them. And the application individually to our lives, not to others' lives, but to our lives. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I had a difficult time admitting I was powerless over alcohol because I could take a drink or leave it alone. I rejected what some groups said, admitted we were powerless over the alcoholic, because I'm Orthodox Al-Anon. It says the 12 steps is adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't say alcoholic in the first step for NAA. It says alcohol. I came to a point where I realized that I was powerless over alcohol, yes, but that wasn't all. I was powerless over time and place and circumstance. I'm powerless over thee and I'm powerless over me. And my life is unmanageable and it's always been unmanageable and is unmanageable when I think I don't need any help and when I forget where I come from and I forget to ask for the guidance I need. When I forget to surrender, when I forget to pray, thy will be done, when I forget that unto myself I am nothing, my life is unmanageable. And that's not failure, it's freedom and it's truth. You see, that step frees me from the responsibility for anyone else. My husband is sober today, not because of me. And he was drunk a lot of years, not because of me. Any success our children have is their success. Any failure they have is their failure. I think we contribute to one another, but we're never the cause of what others are. And when I'm not what I should be, I want you to be the cause of it. And you have to be strong enough to not allow me to push your guilt button. And I have to use my program to be strong enough to not allow you to make me feel responsible for what isn't going on in your life. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had no problems with the need to be restored to sanity. But I took something I'd heard years ago in that Presbyterian church that few are called, many are called, but few are chosen. You're predestined. And I figured I wasn't called and I wasn't chosen and I was destined. And it was kind of like eat, drink, and be merry because it doesn't make any difference. But I came to meetings. I awakened. I started hearing. I stopped judging what you had to say by way you looked. I came to believe in you, not in God, in you, in the things you said. And I put an awesome burden on you. I expected you to be the source of my understanding. And I expected you to wipe my tears. I expected you to understand what I didn't understand. I expected you to forgive me and accept me when I couldn't forgive or accept myself. I was overly dependent upon you. And in that process, because no matter how much you would help me, human beings that you are, you failed me. And rightly so. because I believe God, the God of my understanding, is a jealous God, and He expects me to be totally dependent on Him and not on other human beings. He expects me to, He works through other human beings, but the real source, power is in you, but it's not of you. Wisdom is in you, but it's not of you. It is of God. Anything good is of God. And how much He loves us that He gives us this wisdom and these attributes that we all have, that we can do what He would have us do. He allows us to have these things so we can do what He would have us do. But they're not of us. They're of Him. They're in us because of Him. So I came to believe in the group and the people I was meeting, and I was disappointed when you didn't have my answers and you got worn out with my poor means and there was no place else to go but on to step three. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Made a decision, just that. The journey is still going on about that decision. And sometimes I've stopped along the road and sometimes I've taken a detour. But I've never gone completely back and taken back that final surrender. I'd tried lots of things. I used to take it very superficially. Should I go? God, do you want me to go to Mount Eagle? God, do you want me to go to a meeting tonight? God, you know. I wasn't talking to them once again, those outside things. It wasn't about God, is this what you would have me do? Is this to the glory of God or the glory of Virginia? Is this to obligate someone to me or to show love? You know, that's the real nitty of the decision, the result of the decision. I was praying a prayer that says, God, grant me victory over my difficulties that I may be evidence to others of Thy power. And as I was praying, and I thought, God, if You want me to remain as I am now, unchanged, that's all right. Because I had come to believe by this time that God would give me whatever I needed to do, whatever He would have me do. And if He wanted me to remain unchanged, He'd give me the fortitude to stand it. But quicker than I've been able to share this with you, I knew it wasn't necessary. And to me, that was the ultimate surrender of turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And this is how I started on my journey. And my journey then really started with step four. I had made my decision, you see. I'd come to understand what I was, what I wasn't, what I couldn't do, what He could do, and what I would allow Him to do. I remember saying to my sponsor, I allow God, how presumptuous that I allow God. God's all powerful. I don't allow God. She said, if you don't allow Him, He won't. He will never impose Himself upon you. But my journey started with step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, not of others. We're all still to this day very good at taking other people's inventories, but of ourselves, and not an exercise in self-condemnation, but a true, searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. This is when I started looking up words in the dictionary, because I found people, including myself, used words they really didn't know the meanings of. We have impressions of meanings. You know, a lot of people talk about people being sober just because they're not drinking and going to meetings. Well, if you look up the word sober, you will find that it goes on from that by far. Because to be sober is to be unaffected by prejudice or passion. We will have prejudices and we will have passion, but if we are sober-minded, they will not control our lives. But at any rate, I took this written inventory, I don't even go to the grocery store without a list, and that isn't important as this written inventory, and I admitted to God, myself, and another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. Somebody said, well, why do you talk about how you have told me to put down some of my attributes? Then why don't I talk about my attributes in the fifth step? I said, well, it seems to me like our attributes come from God, and all we're supposed to do is remember they come from Him and thank Him for them. And we do this when we close most of our meetings, when we pray that petition that says, for Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. We turn all of that over to Him then. And their attributes are fine, and they will grow as we grow in the program. It's only these other things we need to take a look at, because most of the time we've denied them. The first time I tried to do a fifth step inventory, this lady's eyebrows went up to her hair and I backed off. I don't know whether I wasn't ready or she wasn't the right one, but then I found a lady and I shared with her, and it was a wonderful feeling. And I'm not one that was seeking for a bolt out of the blue or any vision or anything of that kind. See, I was grateful there wasn't a bolt out of the blue. But I was most grateful for the love and acceptance in her eyes and the sharing of herself that she did with me. And there was a great freedom in talking about those things that I heretofore had only been able to think about, not utter. And I found a lot of things, when spoken aloud, changed in proportion as I heard them and another person heard them, and as I looked into another person's eyes. I found some things I thought were rather insignificant grew measurably as I uttered them and heard them and another person heard them. It's a wonderful experience. If you've not had it, look forward to it. It's grand. It shouldn't be fearful, and you shouldn't be afraid of it. And then she told me what to do, and that was continue to step six, and that is entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And God does the removing, and it's God's timetable. I've become aware of something and I want it removed yesterday. And lots of times God teaches me patience through not removing what he could, because I believe God could do anything he would. I had an experience with self-pity, and I didn't identify the self-pity, and I was talking to somebody about it, and they identified the self-pity. And they told me, I knew in my head what the antidote was, gratitude. So I went home. That's when I started my tacky gratitude list. grateful for dirty dishes, because that means we had something to eat. Grateful for ashtrays that need emptied. I like to smoke, meant I had cigarettes. Be grateful for dirty clothes. That meant we have more than one outfit to wear. Be grateful for these things that I don't want to be grateful for, but be grateful for them, put them down on the list. And my self-pity diminished. And you say, I believe God could have just removed self-pity from me. But he didn't, because I wouldn't have learned anything of gratitude. Pain motivates me, not joy. Pain motivates me. And the seventh step is we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And a lot of people say, if you mention humility, you have none. And I say to them, then don't tell me you're grateful, and don't tell me you love, and don't tell me you're sincere, or don't tell me you're anything else. Because you cannot isolate one human condition or emotion from others and say you don't have it if you mention it, but you have all of the others. But I suppose it's a matter of your perception of what humbly is, and to me, humbly means honestly. And I know, whether anyone else knows or not, I know, and God, as I understand, he knows, and I know he knows, and he knows I know, that I have no right to be here today. I have no right to have in my life what I have today. And I'm not speaking of just clothes to wear, or a car to ride in, or food to eat. I'm talking about those things in here that go with me wherever I go. I talk about love, and I talk about the warmth that you feel with people that is with you when times are hard or you're confused. I talk about awareness of the very existence of God. That's what I'm talking about. Humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. A lot of people debate shortcomings and defects of character. Both of them hurt, and I don't care how you want to describe either one of them, I'll be rid of both of them. And then the eighth step, made a list of persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. My list, I had to put me on my list, and I hope you put you on your list, because I've been harder on me than you've been on me. I had to put my husband on that list. I had to put our children on our list. I had to put just the memory of faces and things I had done, because I didn't know the people. The people in the cars beside me in traffic, and the service station attendants, and clerks in stores that I had just, I would go and make amends to them if I could, but I don't know who they are or where they are. So I asked this God of my understanding to reach into their hearts, and if they have any memory of me that is hurting them or paining them, I asked him to relieve them of that memory. And that's all I can do. And the ninth step says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And of course, I think that very concisely says, I don't have a right to ease my guilty conscience at your expense. In the name of honesty, a lot of people run their fists through the heartstrings of others and saying, I was being honest. No, it may be honest, but cruel, unloving. You don't even hurt a friend in jest. This is my journey, and the result of the journey is that I continue to take a personal inventory when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And that doesn't need any explanation. And it doesn't have to come at the end of the day. It can come when I'm up an hour and everything's going crazy. But to take a look at what works and how to nourish it, what didn't work and how to be rid of it, and to go to those that have harmed. The 11th step is the happiness step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power of it, to carry it out. You know, I think for a lot of time, I deluded myself because the steps are written in the past tense that I too had done them. And it's important for me to bring these steps into the present tense that today I must seek through prayer and meditation, that's the means, what? Knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. That's the program right there. It's the open prayer. It isn't even the multiple choice. Nothing. It's just presenting myself to God and saying, God, it's Virginia. You know more than I know what I need. Help me be receptive to it, you know. Because God hasn't got a thing in store for me but the very best, even though I may not think it's the best. And then the 12th step to me is not a step of, it's a step of awareness in which I turn around and look at the preceding 11 and say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Somebody mentioned the other night something about repetition and being boring and so forth. The word practice means to teach ourselves through repetition. And if you are bored with meetings, if you're bored with the steps, if you're bored with people sharing, you're bored with life. Because this is life. I'm afraid I've run over a little bit. I want to give you, and I wrote it down, I'm starting to suffer from part-timers up here. And because it gives me a couple things that help me remember about the steps. I think for me, step one taught me about acceptance and honesty, and it gave birth to humility. Step two taught me of hope and surrender, and gave birth to faith. Faith with decision in step three allowed me to surrender. In step four, honesty and courage gave birth to integrity. In step five, humility and integrity allowed me to become responsible. Step six, sincerity and willingness gave birth to trust. Step seven, willingness and humility allowed me to take action. Step eight, courage and love allowed me to become outgoing, the real me. Will the real Virginia stand up? The real me. Step nine, charity and self-discipline gave birth to good judgment. Step 10, vigilance and perseverance gave birth to stability. Step 11, serenity and awareness gave birth to peace. Step 12, action and love and service gave birth to life. I thank you very much for allowing me to be here with you. I thank the committee for asking me. And I want to close with some lines that aren't conference approved. But remember, all wisdom comes from God. And those lines know, I know not what the future holds of marvel or surprise. I'm assured alone that life and death, God's mercy underlies. And if my heart and flesh are weak to bear an untried pain, the bruised reed God will not break, but strengthen and sustain. No offering of my own I have, no works my faith to prove. I can but give the gift he gave and plead his love for love. I know not where God's islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. And if my faith is vain and if my hopes betray, pray for me that I may find a surer, safer way. And thou, O Lord, who knows thy creatures as they be, forgive me if too close I lean my human heart to thee. Thank you very much.